You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
And that's why Indigenous communities in Canada and around the world play a critical role in terms of defense of those natural resources, defense of the environment. And unfortunately, in many situations, like in Canada, you know, whether it's the Unist'ot'en communities or the Bertha Caceres of the world, these communities are the front lines of oppression by the state, of incarceration, being murdered due to their opposition and leadership to that, the neoliberal model that is, you know, become the norm globally.
That's the voice of Rural Burbano from Common Frontiers. On this week's show, we speak to Rural about the neoliberal connections between what's happening in places like Venezuela and Honduras, and also here at home to First Nations people and the attack on the public sector in Ontario. So stay tuned.
I'm very privileged this morning to be joined by Raul Burbano, the Executive and Program Director of Common Frontiers. Thank you for joining us, Raul.
Thank you for having me, Sylvia. It's a pleasure.
So can we talk a little bit about the unfolding of this dramatic but very dangerous process that is being retold in the news as a call to bring democracy, as a call to help the people of Venezuela liberate themselves of their elected leader effectively, but who the media in Canada are calling a dictator, someone who's not abiding by law. So can we talk a little bit about that in contrast to our experience of dictatorships in Central America and how the two compare?
But the reality is what's happening today, you know, if we contrast Venezuela, Honduras, Central America, Latin America, is a continuation of, you know, Canada, U.S., you know, foreign policy in Latin America and in other parts of the world, but, you know, specifically Latin America that we're focused on right now, you know, that the U.S. with its allies in the West are going to decide who and what will be running our countries in Latin America. So, you know, from the 60s, 70s, 80s, where dictatorships in Latin America that were, you know, engaged in, you know, massive brutal repression, those governments were accepted and supported by, you know, the U.S. and Canadian administrations, all because, you know, it was a, you know, the war against communism or the Cold War, and those crimes in essence were acceptable to maintain a certain order within the region. And unfortunately, today we see that continuing to play out. For example, in Venezuela, there has been, as I'm sure your audience members know, since 1999, a Bolivarian government that was first elected by Chavez, and, you know, the policies of Chavez are continued in the current President Maduro, which are, for example, would run counter to the neoliberal policies that, you know, the U.S. and Canadian governments are, you know, in essence imposing here in Canada and around the world. And we can talk a little bit about, for example, what's happening in Ontario with the privatization of the healthcare system or the proposed privatization of the healthcare system. We see the same thing happening in Honduras, for example. So last week, there were massive protests, thousands of workers and youth marching in Tegucigalpa, Honduras, in response to the Juan Orlando government, who wants to implement the privatization and reforms to the healthcare and education system, which would result in massive cuts, firing, privatization, you know, of the public and healthcare system. So many of the protests were led by teachers, you know, and medical union students who want, you know, the government of Juan Orlando, who has been implicated in electoral fraud. The OAS, 2017, the OAS found that, you know, there was, you know, significant voter fraud and that, you know, elections should be redone again. But yet, you know, the Canadian government, the U.S. government all support Juan Orlando. The protesters, many of them were peaceful, were met with massive police repression. And, you know, and of course, in the mainstream media, these protesters are considered violent and are portrayed in a very different light than, for example, when you look at Venezuela. Venezuela, who has a democratically elected government of Nicolas Maduro. I was there as an international observer with about 300 other international observers who participated in the elections. And yet the U.S. has decided, along with its allies in the Lima group, which are, you know, like a non-existent group of the OAS who have come together, Canada, Peru, Brazil, to decide that in Venezuela, you know, the elected government is not legitimate because the elected government doesn't follow, is in essence not a puppet. Like in Honduras, Juan Orlando is a puppet of the U.S. Maduro is not a puppet of the U.S. And so they've been looking to overthrow him for the last, you know, since he was, you know, since he's taken power in 2014, 2015 through imposing, you know, harsh economic sanctions that are hurting the people, that are causing, you know, scarcity in products, helping to incite riots and violence by opposition protesters, many of them extremely violent. And yet, you know, that's portrayed as a democratic uprising and is praised in the mainstream media and by our governments as something that's good. For example, you know, just this week, last week that passed, Juan Guaido, who's the self-proclaimed individual who says he has legitimacy to the presidency, I've called for a military uprising in the country. So he got together with the support of a small, you know, group of military personnel with guns, and they were like, we're going to take the military base of La Carlota in Caracas, and, you know, just like that. And of course, the mainstream media, you know, supporting him, saying that, you know, this is a wonderful, important uprising for democracy. We hear in the U.S., Pompeo, Elliot Abrams, John Bolton, all supporting, you know, this move of a violent, you know, military uprising against a democratically elected government as something that is, you know, that is important and needed because it's for democracy. But, you know, we all know that Juan Guaido is a puppet of the U.S., and he's doing, you know, the whatever the U.S. wants him to do. And the goal really is for the U.S. and, you know, multinational corporations to get their hands on the plethora of natural resources that Venezuela has. For example, most people know that Venezuela has the largest proven resources of oil. It has large deposits of gold. All these types of, you know, natural wealth is what the U.S. has made it pretty clear that, you know, the difference, I think, between the current administration today, Trump, and from example, Obama, is that, you know, they're pretty clear in what they're doing in Venezuela. And they've said their goal is really to ensure that, you know, U.S. corporations have their hands on the natural resources because that will benefit the Venezuelans, but at the same time, it would benefit Americans and American corporations. So we see this sort of ongoing politics of the U.S., which hasn't ended, you know, U.S. imperialism, the Monroe Doctrine, which has been going on for, you know, decades. You know, it just really takes different forms. Today in Venezuela, it's taken the form of economic sabotage with financial sanctions that is causing immense hardships in Venezuela today, where there are reports from, you know, different institutions. For example, the Center for Economic and Policy Research, which are, you know, economists Jeffrey Zaks and Mark Weisbrot, have put out a report recently that said up to 40,000 people have died in Venezuela since 2017 as a result of the U.S. sanctions.
With every war, and I can speak directly to El Salvador, you know, it has been an intensification of corporations abroad being able to just simply run roughshod. In the case of El Salvador, the constitution was ripped up and rewritten in the name of mining companies, so mining companies could have access. Many people may not know this, but Canada was so-called the peace broker in the talks for peace in El Salvador. And this is what peace brought us. Peace brought us a new constitution that basically gave rights to corporations over the land. Now, that's one example, but we are talking today about Honduras primarily because the violence and the insecurity of people in Honduras have, you know, exacerbated, and there are people moving en masse to the U.S. There's the caravan of Honduras coming to the U.S., but because we're so busy hearing from the news how, you know, important is this invasion of Venezuela, this you know, to end the example that Venezuela has placed as a country that has appropriated their natural resources for their people. They're nationalized their resources, and they're not denying anyone access to it. They're still selling. They're very much still a capitalist country in terms of selling their resources and participating in the market. But it's because I think they are a government that operates in the benefit of their people first that this is a bad example. So can we talk a little bit about this contrast? Because while we're seeing a move to so-called promote democracy, on one hand we're talking democracy, on the other hand we're sending military people to kill and plunder.
The narrative of we're there for democracy, to support human rights in Venezuela, for example, we know that it's really used as a smokescreen to mask the reality of what, you know, the Canadian and you know, U.S. foreign policy is in Latin America, which is exactly what you said, which is getting their hands on or control of, or at least in implement puppet governments that will allow our countries to get a hold of and control of the natural resources in our country. So, for example, I mean, you mentioned El Salvador is a good example, but Honduras is a very similar situation where we know today that the government of Juan Orlando is a continuation of policies in a government that, you know, was installed by a U.S.-backed coup in 2009 that overthrew the democratically elected government of Manuel Zelaya. The government of Manuel Zelaya was more of a leftist government. It believed, similar to what Maduro believes in today, and implemented similar policies in Honduras that the Venezuelan government does, which is the redistribution of some of the wealth to its people by subsidizing gas, for example, had joined the ALBA movement, which is, you know, back 10 years ago or so, the configuration of the leftist governments to, you know, to sell oil for, you know, different products to each other. And really the coup d'etat, what it ushered in 2009, beyond massive violence for the people in Honduras, is also we've seen, for example, a significant uptake for, you know, U.S. and Canadian corporations in terms of investment in Honduras. I mean, the Canadian government provided technical assistance and support for the general mining and hydrocarbons law that was passed in 2013, you know, when you had a dictatorship, basically, you know, after a few years of a coup in Honduras. The majority of Hondurans were opposed to this reform, and what it allowed was to lift the mining moratorium in Honduras that more mining could be implemented in the country. And we know that, you know, mining in Honduras, for example, is a big problem in terms of that's where a lot of the conflict takes place, in areas where there are mega projects, extractive projects, because often communities, whether they're, you know, the Garifuna communities in Honduras, the Lencar indigenous communities in other parts of Honduras that are opposed to the destruction of their environment, of their culture by these mega extractive companies, the state has to come in and impose a militarized solution to that. And we've seen, for example, in Honduras, the assassination of Berta Cáceres, a well-known indigenous Lenca activist with COPIN for their opposition to, you know, massive infrastructure projects that we know that they know would destroy their community, you know, the environment. And these are the policies that our neoliberal governments continue to push. We see that here in Ontario, for example. The Ford government is passing, you know, potentially a bill that would privatize healthcare or open the door to privatization of healthcare here in Ontario. These are the policies that we want implemented, our governments want implemented, conservative governments like the Ford government want imposed on the people of Ontario. We also want those policies imposed around the world, because if other countries have other policies like, for example, when Manuel Zelaya had in Honduras back in 2009, or Nicolas Maduro today has in Venezuela, which is, you know, providing free access for healthcare for people in their countries. Those are examples of bad policies. And people say, well, you know what, if Venezuela, who is, you know, considered technically a poor country, or, you know, a country in the global south, can provide healthcare, can provide, you know, two to three million worth of housing, public housing for low income families. If Venezuela can provide access to education, you know, for, you know, their citizens, then why can't we do it in Canada and in the U.S., where countries that are supposed to be, you know, in the north, first world quote unquote first world countries that have lots of resources and money. Because I think it comes down to what is our priority and where do we want to put our funds. We're looking at privatizing our healthcare, firing of our teachers, for example, the reduction in class sizes. This is going to have a tremendous social impact, you know, going forward. And really, what is the solution? Is investing in militarization in our countries, the investment in the jail system, right, in the incarceration complex, because that's the new big business. Because people are starting to, you know, organize, or starting to feel, wow, our systems are being really privatized, and we don't have access to some of the basic things that we used to have in Canada. And if we're not careful, we will end up very similar to countries like Honduras, where, you know, the privatization of the healthcare and the education system is a given. And I think that's where a lot of people, for example, in Ontario today, are starting to realize, and there's lots of mobilization and protests against the Ford government for these nefarious policies that seek to, you know, open the privatization in our education and healthcare system to corporations.
What if we were to dedicate as much effort and funding, you know, that we're diluting, sending to illogical wars abroad, let the people in Venezuela decide for themselves what their democratic process will look like. Let them figure out how they want to govern themselves and elect who they want to elect. And let us focus on, you know, making our governments accountable to the needs of our people, to creating sustainable housing here. In Vancouver, there's homeless people everywhere. You know, the average condominium is like 500 square feet, and you have to pay, you know, $499,000 for it. Who can afford that when we have wages that are stagnant? Who can afford that when unions are on the decline in Canada? So we have our own process of democratic, you know, growth to take place in our own land. We have no business declaring wars or upholding military coups in other places in the world. So I want to talk a little bit about the role of labor, the role of us as workers, as peoples, as brothers, as family members in our society to co-create this consciousness of what it means to create a world, because we're all interconnected. You know, what happens here affects what happens in other places. What happens in Venezuela will affect us all as people who have to work for wages.
I think the role of labor is critical in terms of, we see that, you know, our economy has become a precarious economy where good paying union jobs that, you know, historically have people could make a living off, that had, you know, access to healthcare benefits, you know, pension plans, all those gains that, you know, the union movement and workers coming together and fighting for that have gained are now being, you know, taken back. And unless, you know, people come together, you know, supporting the labor movement, supporting human rights, supporting real democracy, you know, what we're going to see is a continuation of those policies of precarity, of discrimination, of racism, right? Because just like similar, like we see in the U.S., when there are economic downturns, or when people see that they have no options, you know, in their own future, then they look for scapegoats, right? They look for, you know, what are the causes of their problems. And in many cases, due to the media, due to misinformation, people don't have a sense of what those causes are, you know, whether it be economically, politically, or socially. So in the U.S., for example, what are people turning to? They're blaming immigrants, right? They're blaming migrants as the cause of their state of precarity, which we've seen in the U.S., you know, for example, where, many miners in the Midwest or in other parts of the country have lost their jobs, right? And can't find other work. So what the people start to look at for sort of scapegoats. And what we see is, what you see is a division within communities, which you see is a polarization of us and them, right? In Canada, we see that as an anti-Islamophobia process, where now, you know, there is lots of, you know, discrimination and racism, you know, against people who practice the faith of Islam, because we're seeing it as, you know, this is a group that's coming and potentially they're changing our culture and our values and our economy. And hence, you know, instead of looking at what are the, you know, the root causes of our issues and seeing that, you know, those are, you know, often stem from, you know, failed policies by our governments, which are really looking at dismantling our democratic process. Because we have to keep in mind, democracy is only good if it's supporting the status quo. When democracy works as it should, which is when the people decide what is it that they want, and they get active and they get organized, they may challenge that status quo. meaning, for example, today, the status quo is that corporations can dictate to governments, to people, what are the policies that are going to be implemented around the world, you know, locally, whether it's, it doesn't make a difference if it's in Canada or if it's in Honduras, you know, global corporations, capital have so much power and influence and have in essence co-opted our governments that our democratic systems in essence don't function and are being used in order to promote policies, for example, that destroy the environment, that run counter to, you know, the needs of the majority of people, but yet at the same time are supporting and making it easier for corporations to get away from crimes that, you know, normally they would be charged for the destruction of the environment, to ensure that they, you know, their profits aren't being taxed at anywhere realistic, right? Democracy is only as good as it supports a status quo, which today is the running of our systems, of our democratic systems, by multinational corporations. And as movements mobilize to challenge that, whether it's in Honduras today, where the masses of people are on the streets fighting the privatization of their healthcare and education system, I mean, those policies aren't coming from the government, Juan Orlando. Those policies of privatization are coming from the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, which is really, you know, an arm of the U.S. and multinational capital that wants those institutions in Honduras privatized, so then multinational corporations can make lots of money, which is very similar to what we see in Canada, right? The push for, you know, the cutting of the healthcare system, of the education system, is basically to debilitate and destroy the system so then we can say, well, of course, the only thing that could save the healthcare system is privatization. And of course, who benefits in privatization? It's not citizens. It's not your average person. It's multinational corporations who will see massive profits when those systems are privatized. And we know that in many cases, those profits aren't reinvested as the, you know, the theory of, you know, micro or macroeconomics would suggest in capitalism, that, you know, companies invest and that trickles down to the average person. What you're seeing is that your average person is living a precarious life. They don't have access to basic services anymore. And unless you can pay for them, we're becoming very similar to the U.S. where you just don't have access to them. And corporations are making quite a lot of money. And most of their, you know, revenue is being sheltered in international tax havens, as we've seen. So, you know, that's a big challenge. And I think that from, you know, from Canada to Honduras are similar struggles that we're seeing. And that's why it's important to, you know, as you mentioned, you know, understand our history and know that these aren't new policies. This isn't unique. This is sort of a, I would say, a colonial mindset that has been imposed by, you know, the elites and international capital on a global sense, that seeks that the natural resources should be commodified and should be for profit, but those losses should be socialized, and that should be in the hands of us to recover. And we see that on a global scale. And that's why indigenous communities in Canada and around the world play a critical role in terms of defense of those natural resources, defense of the environment. And unfortunately, in many situations, like in Canada, you know, whether it's the Unist'ot'en communities or the Bertha, you know, the Bertha Cáceres of the world, these communities are the front lines of oppression by the state, of incarceration, being murdered due to their opposition and leadership to that, you know, the neoliberal model that is, you know, become the norm globally.
I guess as we come into the end of our interview, I want to ask you, what inspires you that we can get this done, that we can, you know, stop this warmongering, you know, in our name, and that we can co-create social systems that support life, that allow us to move, you know, in a more responsive and more regenerative way as we go forward?
I mean, when you look back at history, especially within Latin America between 2000 and 2014, the pink tide countries, you know, they're considered the leftist governments, from Lula in Brazil to Correa in Ecuador to Chavez in Venezuela. These countries, you know, in a general sense, implemented policies that were beneficial to the majority of their citizens. So, for example, between 2000 and 2014, you know, the percentage of people living in Latin America in massive poverty, people who made, for example, less than $4 a day, shrank, right, by, you know, from 45 to 25%. So they lifted massive numbers of people in Latin America out of poverty. They shifted, you know, the focus from war and militarization for example, closing down military bases, to social spending. And that had a tremendous impact, you know, overall in Latin America. I mean, you know, these leftist governments, think tank governments, did a lot of things that were wrong as well. They weren't perfect. They made a lot of mistakes as well. But no one can deny, questionably, that they were able to use the natural resources from their countries to benefit the majority of people by implementing policies like access to healthcare, whether it's free, education, housing, and it had a significant impact on people's lives. And what this did at the same time is that it engaged, you know, citizenry, people in their democratic systems.
When they realized that if we take our natural resources or our wealth and we divert it and put it and prioritize policies that benefit the majority of people, what it does is it creates a sense of democratic participation. And people became more engaged in their democratic systems, became more critical of U.S. foreign policy in their countries. For example, we saw the closing down of military bases that, you know, in many cases supported U.S. intervention in countries. We saw communities engaging in, you know, pushing against extractive industries, so moratoriums against mining, against extractive industries. We saw, you know, very important policies where people were being engaged. And I believe that this has caused a significant problem for U.S. and Canadian foreign policy in the region because, one, it marginalized their interest in the region, you know, U.S. and Canadian, which in many cases, unfortunately, is an imperialist policy, which is about how can our corporations, multinational corporations, be it, you know, mining companies or infrastructure companies, can benefit at the expense of these of communities in the global south. And, you know, so it's inspiring for me to see how communities were able to come together for a decade, over a decade, in order to take control of their democratic system. Because what's happened is that, you know, we're living in a world where our democratic system is being usurped and corporations have all the power. And unfortunately, it doesn't matter, you know, what party, whether it's, you know, conservatives, liberals, we see very similar policies being implemented, which are policies that benefit corporations. In many cases have direct and negative impact on the population, on the environment, on indigenous rights. And we see this time and time again, and we see it across continents. I mean, it's not that different from what we've seen in Honduras, in Colombia, where there's, you know, massive repression of indigenous communities in Colombia. We see that in Canada, we have a crisis of missing and murdered indigenous women and girls across Canada. And our, you know, our justice system, in essence, there is impunity there. The people who have been engaged in these acts have not been brought to justice. Not that different from what's happened in Colombia, in a different context, of course, where, you know, the state in many situations is involved in the disappearance and murder of indigenous communities, and yet there is impunity in those countries. But when corporations have a need or want, you know, to engage in extractivism, there is no shortage for when the state will come to their rescue to support them, to ensure that they can implement, you know, their projects. So the inspiration is communities coming together, realizing that there are alternatives, that realizing that, you know, the environment is a critical component, and without it, we can't continue to live. So we have to find economic, political, and social systems that can live in harmony with the environment, with each other, and ensure that, you know, longevity for, you know, the seventh generation to come forward.
Thank you again for being with us today. Give our audience your website, or how can they contact Common Frontiers?
Sure. Our website is www.commonfrontiers.ca. And people can access our information there. And if they have any questions, they could send me an email at burbano@rogers, that's B-U-R-B-A-N-O, @rogers.com. And I'd be happy to answer any questions to provide more information.
Thank you again. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you, and bye for now.